This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'm delighted now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Bill Fishbein. He's founder and executive director of the Coffee Trust, and he will be in a conversation about coffee that is happening this Saturday, the 26th of March, at 6 o'clock at Iconic Coffee Roasters. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And we are here to talk about, among other things, coffee and an event that is happening this Saturday, the 26th of March, at 6 o'clock at Iconic Coffee Roasters. It's a conversation about coffee, and that's what we're going to have today. Let's start with you, Bill Fishbein. You are founder and director of the Coffee Trust, but you have had basically a life in coffee and a passion for coffee that started when you were quite young.
Yes, that's true. That's true. The story is, or the myth is, that I fell in love when I was 19 years old with a young woman from Venezuela, and she used to make coffee as we studied together in the night. And she did not stay in love with me too long, but the coffee stayed with me. And every business that I went into after college, coffee had some role to play in it.
That's funny that you call it a myth.
Well, it's sort of like a myth. It's what happened, but I've kind of, it's grown into me.
Right.
It's grown into me, yeah.
And so then you started a coffee business.
I did. All my history, I have a long history with coffee. As I said, every business that I went into, coffee played a role in it. When I was in the restaurant equipment business, I opened up a small office coffee business just because I wanted to be around coffee. And then when I went into the housewares business, the professional cookware for the home, and I put a section of specialty coffees in there. Had three of those businesses going, and then I opened up a restaurant. And there is a 200-seat restaurant with another coffee section in it. And so I had four businesses going with my family at the time. And we were always taking two steps forward and three steps back. And eventually we lost everything. I had literally no money. I was not bankable, could not get any credit at all. And I borrowed $4,000 from a friend to start the tiniest little coffee business you could imagine. All I could do was buy wholesale roasted coffee and sell it over the counter. I couldn't afford an espresso machine. I couldn't afford to put in a bar. And at that time, it was before the real coffee boom in the United States.
When was that?
That was 1984 when I started that business.
So that was just about the time when high-end coffee was just beginning to enter the consciousness of people, as opposed to sort of like supermarket coffee.
Yeah, in fact, people used to come to me and say, why should I pay $4 a pound for coffee from you when I can buy it for $2 in the supermarket?
So, and then you would give them a taste test.
All it would take is a taste. That's all. I mean, they would buy a pound and then they would go back to the supermarket and get their regular coffee. And then they would taste the supermarket coffee against what they had, and they can never go back.
You know, I remember back in the old days, an airport cup of coffee was disgusting. It was undrinkable. It was like rot gut. And now you can get a really fine espresso in an airport.
You can, Mary Charlotte.
What do you mean?
I don't think that today, with the quality of coffee that's being served over the counter, where America's palate has improved so much, the airport's still not a great place to get a cup of coffee.
Yeah, but compare it to 1980.
Well, compare any coffee to 1980, right?
Yeah. So I guess what I mean, how do you account for that really major change of American taste?
Clearly, in the late 70s, a small cadre of individuals began to pursue high-quality coffee. They climbed mountains and looked for small producers who would produce a real high-quality product. And this specialty coffee movement began back in the late 70s. And at that time, a coffee roaster really couldn't buy a bag of green coffee. You just couldn't do it. You had to have a friend who worked at Procter and Gamble for one of their outfits, or Maxwell House, so you could grab a bag of green coffee for him. But by the mid-80s, everybody was selling one bag of coffee. Brokers were selling one bag of coffee because there was this demand from this small cadre of coffee roasters. And that demand grew as time grew on. And the America's palate began to improve in the late 70s and early 80s in small little pockets throughout the country. When I started back in 1984, my second foray into the coffee trade, or my third foray into the coffee trade, there were not that many specialty coffee businesses in the country. There probably were maybe less than 100.
So you had a real market niche.
Well, I was part of that cadre that was developing that market niche. It was still pretty small. But those who tried really good coffee wouldn't go back. So they would tell their friends, and more people would come. And little by little, the industry grew based on the quality of coffee that was served over the counter.
Do you think there was any influence of Italy at espresso and Italian coffee? And the reason I asked that was because the improvement in the availability of good coffee paralleled the improvement in the availability of good olive oil.
That's interesting. I think that on or about during the 70s, I think the baby boomers were like the drifters, and like Michener's drifters were traveling throughout Europe and actually tasting coffee. And it didn't remind them of what they used to have in the States. And I think that when they returned, they tried to improve the quality of coffee and other things as well.
So your little business that started with $4,000 and a bag of beans or whatever really grew and took off. What did that trajectory look like?
It was very slow in the beginning because $4,000 is not a very big capital investment, so I had a lot of time to think.
Now, you were in Rhode Island.
I was in Providence, Rhode Island, yeah. And what it looked like was I would be sitting around waiting for customers to come in, and it was very slow. In fact, my friends used to come in and see me behind the counter with the coffee beans aging in front of me, and they would say, "Billy, get a job."
Yeah, right.
You know. So it took a long time, but finally I had accumulated enough profits to buy an old beat-up Eterna espresso machine, bought some tables and chairs, and before I knew it, I had a line out the door. And when that happened, something very different happened to me, because I had been struggling most of my life with my family to get ahead. And there was always, as I said, two steps forward and three steps back. And there was always we always had some sort of debt against us. With the coffee exchange, at a certain point in 1988, I had a few hundred dollars in my pocket, and I had no debt against me. And I had never been there in my life. And one might think I was thrilled, but I actually went into an emotional turmoil, because I felt I was leaving a struggle. I was crossing a line that I had never crossed before. And I went into a very confused state. I saw a play, a Tennessee Williams play, that completely rocked me. And it was a play called Camino Real, which made me look at myself. And the history of the play is it makes people look at themselves. And most, after the first act, people leave because it's a very disturbing play. But I stayed through it with half the audience. And afterwards, I kept seeing myself and who I was in very different lights.
Isn't that amazing? I just would like to point out the power of art.
Art literally changed my life. I had been in business ever since I was selling newspapers as a kid, and I looked at life through the eyes of a business person. And when I began to look at myself and see that coffee, this amazing elixir that had pulled me out of a financial abyss to some level of financial security, that it was hardly as generous to the people who grew and cared for it as it had been to me. And through a few serendipitous events, the play a few dreams, some books that I read. I was led to Guatemala for the first time in 1988.
So you started thinking about not only how do I sell this coffee, but where does it come from and what are the lives like of the people who were growing it?
I knew nothing about coffee at that time other than I loved it. And to me, it came from the back of a truck. When I confronted that reality, I was compelled to go see, visit and to know coffee farmers for the first time. And when I went to Guatemala in 1988 and I saw the poverty and I saw this in the incredible communities that were, the communities were thriving within the poverty, I was the one who felt impoverished. And I just wanted to remain connected to them. So when I returned, I started another organization, not the Coffee Trust. The first organization I started was Coffee Kids. And that was basically started so I could just make contributions out of my own income. I had no intention of turning it into an international organization. But the word spread, and little by little, more people wanted to get involved. Before I knew it, I was asking my brother to run my business so I could pursue the work with coffee farmers.
So what was the nature of that work? What did you see? How did you work with them? I mean, there's something about, I mean, there's an archetype of an American going to an impoverished place and saying, I am here to help. And it's not always like really successful or effective.
That's an interesting point, because when I started, I literally thought I was going to ride into town on a white horse and save the day. I thought it was all about money. And I thought I was just going to write checks, and that was it. That's all I was going to do. And it wasn't too long before I realized, particularly when I started a project with some farmers in the eastern side of Guatemala to help them improve the quality and yield of their crop. About a year and a half later, the coffee prices plummeted and the farmers lost their farms. And I kind of looked at myself and say, nice job, Bill. You know, you really did a great job here. And I realized that I had no business imposing what my idea of what made sense in Guatemala to farmers who lived there. And I decided that it was time for me to shut up and to start listening. And when I did, I began to hear things I never heard before. Like coffee is not enough. It doesn't matter what the price of coffee is or how much we sell, we still don't have enough to feed our families.
Which is kind of amazing. How does that work? Like, what if the price of coffee is really high? It still doesn't give them enough income?
No, it's near enough income. And look, oftentimes the owner of the estate gets most of it anyway. And for one person to get the bulk of the funding and to share a little bit with the rest is really not beneficial to the rest. And even so, the price of coffee is fixed in a world coffee market, which, just to give you an example, back in 1988, the world price of unroasted coffee was somewhere in the neighborhood of $1.25 or $1.30.
A pound,
right. And today, the fixed price, the same price of coffee is fixed at $1.25 or $1.30. And it's like 30 years later.
Yeah.
And they say, well, is there any inflation that took place in 30 years? Well, there certainly must have been. So the price of coffee has continually eroded, you know, and it continuously erodes to inflation. And somehow the world markets are established in such a way that there's always an oversupply of coffee. Most of it is poor quality coffee. But those poor quality coffees, even though it's like completely different than specialty coffee, it affects the price of specialty coffee, suppressing that price. And all premiums that are paid onto the price of coffee, the premiums for the quality, premiums for fair trade, premiums for direct trade, premiums for rainforest coffee, and all those premiums, organic premiums, whatever they are, the quality premiums, and there are a number of them. They're all built on top of this price of coffee that today, if you figured inflation in 1988 dollars, let's say the $1.25 or $1.30 price of coffee today is probably worth about 70 or 60 cents.
Yeah.
So you add you're only paying the premium. I mean, it's like, it just doesn't work. It doesn't work. And so as much as the higher price roasters are paying for coffee, for really high quality coffee. And that is a benefit for the farmers. Every nickel more that a farmer gets is better than less. It's just still not enough. And what I was hearing from coffee farmers back there was, we need alternatives to coffee. Of course we need coffee. Coffee's our income, but it's not enough. We need other businesses so we can earn income. We need education for our kids. We need health care. We need to learn how to grow food products for ourselves, because we've lost that knowledge. The ancient knowledge that we had generations ago has been lost because we've been seduced into the coffee world for the benefits of the cash from coffee.
Now, what I hear you saying is that these coffee farmers don't own their land.
No, some do. Some own their land. Some don't. Some rent their land. The land where the coffee trust is working these days in San Gaspar Chahul, in the Ishil region of Guatemala, the land's very small. They'll have maybe a half an acre of land or an acre of land, and that's what they've got. And then they have to divide that up against their children, because there's not much land left over as well. So but some are owners and some are not, but the plan only can produce so much.
We're talking to Bill Fishbein of the Coffee Trust. Now, there's something that I think is important to talk about, which is that monocrops, which coffee is and which all commodity crops are, tend to be grown in huge swaths of only that crop, which isn't healthy for the soil. And it makes the farmers, whether they're corn farmers or coffee farmers or whatever, very vulnerable to the fluctuations of the market. Are there movements to do like crop rotation and some subsistence farming of food that the families actually eat?
There is a great deal of intercropping going on there. What you described is what's called technified coffee. And there's a lot of chemicals are used, and you see rolling hills of coffee, and it's very beautiful to look at. But it's really horrible for the soil that eventually burns out, and it is commodity pricing. Those prices still affect the farmers who grow in a multi-level canopies of shade and intercropping alongside. The intercropping with coffee is not enough to grow food for them. You can get some beans grown in along with the coffee, and you get some fruit trees and banana trees. But in order to grow food, you really need some land to grow the food. Not that much land. And so what we do in part of our program is we are working with farmers to, mostly the women, to produce productive family gardens for their complete vegetables. And we have systems to for families to care for chickens, so they can have eggs and they can have chicken and they can sell eggs and chicken. So there are, it's very important to have a more diversified income, more diversified food source.
So when you went down to Guatemala and you said, I started just shutting up and listening, that's what you heard. We need diversified income sources, things like that.
Basically, what we heard was coffee's not enough. And so then we began, my growth curve has been steady. And so initially I started putting in projects that I'm responding to the farmers, putting in the projects that they want. And over the years, I've learned that it's not that simple, that it's more important to put the skills into the hands of the farmers so they can implement their own programs. Better than I come with a program, no matter how good it is, that the farmers should create the programs themselves. So when women, for example, we have a women's savings and microcredit program up in the Enchil region, where 20 women started a program because hundreds of them had lost their jobs as coffee sorters who'd select the defects because the coffee cooperative bought a machine that did their work. 20 women started a program. And so what the Coffee Trust did was provide training for them so they would understand what loans were, what savings were, so they would understand how to administer a program. But it was their program that they wanted. And little by little, today there's 1,600 women in the program. It's completely financially sustainable. They have their own savings fund because of what they've done with their own ingenuity, their own creativity, and their own sense of business.
When you are in Guatemala and a lot of other places in Central America and in the coffee-growing regions, the people you're talking to are essentially indigenous people, people of indigenous ancestry. Do any of the indigenous cultural practices of living and food growing remain? Is that part of their lives?
Very much a part of their lives, indeed. I mean, the foods that they eat in this particular region, one of the staples is called, they're called boshboles. And there it's a corn-based food that is wrapped in a green leaf and served with some sort of salsa. It's been around for centuries.
I mean, the reason I ask is because when we use the word poverty, it's a different thing to talk about poverty in the inner city in the United States, where people have to rent apartments and they have to get around and they have to buy groceries and so on, versus genuinely land-based, village-based, or tribal-based cultures that have a completely different way of doing things, and those words mean different things, like poverty.
It's true. I wouldn't dare try to compare the two, because people who live in poverty, whether they're in the inner cities or in a rural area, suffer beyond understanding, at least beyond my understanding.
What was the kind of suffering that you were seeing there?
Well, you'd see little children with distended bellies. You'd see...
From starvation?
Yeah. You'd see... little streams trickling down through the village, and it was human waste. There was no education. In fact, where we're working even today, the Ishil people, on average, don't get beyond the second grade. There's no health care. There may be one doctor for 80,000 people who can't afford him anyway. So there's no health care.
And so there's no, like, indigenous herbalism, things like that?
No, but that's part of what our work is that what we do is we hire... The women want to learn about medicinal herbs and traditional medicine.
Things are gone. I mean, what I was asking. Yeah. Those cultural practices have not survived, and they have to be relearned.
Right. They haven't survived in these areas, but they have survived elsewhere. So what our work is to try to put people together who can share their knowledge with farmers who don't have that information. And so recreating what existed many years before is part of what it is. And we don't do the work. We just bring the people together so they can share what they know with other farmers.
So what have been the greatest successes of the work that you've done with Coffee Kids and the Coffee Trust? And what have been the mistakes?
The successes have been in women's savings and microcredit. We've had a great amount of success in that program, in those programs, whether it was with Coffee Kids or the Coffee Trust. With Coffee Kids, I remember meeting women who, you know, many didn't even have shoes and had tattered clothes. And, you know, many years later, we would have like a convention and they were dressed to the nines with heels and new duds that they had just bought. And they had, you know, income for their families separate from coffee.
Yeah.
And empowerment, which is... for women in Latin America, particularly rural areas in Latin America, is an enormous accomplishment. And the same thing is happening here in the Ishil region of Guatemala, where women have created their own savings fund, where they are now in complete charge of their life. They do not need to borrow any more money. They've even made their own relationships with the Kiva Foundation, which provides zero interest loans for their expansion. They've been accepted by the Swedish embassy in Guatemala to give up to $500,000 in grant money for expansion. They're totally on their own. The only work we do with them now is to help them with consultants to train them to become better financial managers, because they're not going to be dealing with 1,600 women in a few years. They're going to be dealing with 5,000 or more. Yeah. So the nature of their microcredit program will change dramatically, and they have to have the skills to deal with that. So that would be, I would say, one of our greatest, or the greatest successes that I've seen. Education. We have sent young people to middle school, high school, even university. Some of them are working for us now as technicians or promoters on our agricultural recovery program that we're working with the farmers now. Some of them are working in our food sovereignty program. So our education, investment education, has really paid off. And food sovereignty has paid off in the past. It's a struggle in the Ishil region because the families have such a small amount of land, and it's really painfully poor quality. But we use different methods, particularly effective microorganisms, to help transform the potential in the soil into something that the plants can absorb and grow, so they can provide more food for their families.
And be resistant to the coffee fungus.
Exactly. I mean, there's a terrible fungus going on through Central America, and that's one of the reasons we got involved in it's rust, and rust in Spanish is roya. And so the roya project that we're involved in right now, we were invited or asked to help the farming community that we're working with, because they lost 75% of their production to La Roya. And so far, we have almost doubled their production from the time we took over. So that so far is developing into a very strong program. The essence behind the work that we do, not necessarily the work that we do, but the way we do the work, is called, there's a name for it, it's called campesino a campesino, which means farmer to farmer. And basically, it's built upon the belief that farmers learn from each other better than they learn from a professional. And so even a local professional who may be training farmers in a particular practice, the farmer receives that information, but he receives it from a professional. And it, just that transfer of information, you know, he or she may feel, oh boy, that man is very smart, he's been to college, I wish that I could be as capable as he or she is. But when a farmer learns from another farmer, his neighbor, her neighbor, the experience is, if she can do it, so can I.
Yeah.
Or if he can do it, so can I. And it's completely empowering. And that's a huge shift from farmers who feel that they are hopeless, their situation is hopeless, to transform farmer attitude toward improving their lives into one from hopelessness to one from I can do this is enormous. And that has been an amazing success, whether it's been in the Roya Project, the Women's Microcredit Project, the Honey Farming Project, the Women's Weaving Project, whether it's been in the medicinal herbs or traditional medicines or education, whatever project we've been involved in, the way we deal with it is through this methodology, campesino a campesino, which literally empowers the farmer to pursue their own growth based upon their own vision of the future.
So the alternative non-coffee businesses are honey, weaving.
Well, yeah, honey and weaving are major ones. But of the 1,600 women who are in the savings and credit program, I won't say there are 1,600 different businesses, but there are a number, myriad different businesses that are operating, whether it's a small tienda, whether it's a chocolate banana business, whether it might be a small family garden, whether it may be investing in some chickens. It could be any number of things. And when people, when their backs are to the wall, they are the most creative and entrepreneurial you could ever imagine. And given even the smallest amount of money to Invest in what their dreams are, what their dream for their future is. As small as help, it's amazing what they can do with it. And they tend to use the benefits of, at least the women do, to use the benefits of what they've gained for the benefit of their family.
And I can't help but see a funny parallel of, like, you got a micro loan in 1977 and built a business, and they did too.
I've thought of that on a number of times. Yeah. $4,000. It was 1984 that I got the loan. That it wasn't worth very much then.
Right.
But it literally is the same thing.
That planted the seed. Now, this is all a movement for social justice, for economic development, for equality, for ecological health, and you've done some amazing things, and you're part of a larger movement. I mean, we go into Trader Joe's or wherever and see fair trade coffee and organic coffee and all of these things, which you earlier called premiums. But these are things that people care about because it's about the lives of people and the lives of ecosystems, the health of ecosystems. How widespread is this kind of activity in the coffee growing areas of Latin America?
When you say widespread, you mean fair trade and the different premiums that...
Well, those things and the kind of work that you're doing.
I wish I would say it was widespread. The kind of work that we're doing is not... I think for the most part, and I'm not throwing stones here, that it seems so easy to, the problem seems so easy to solve. It's like, oh, geez, all we need to do is put in a system here and we've done it.
It's self-perpetuating.
Yeah. Well, right. But what I mean is it's easy for nonprofits to see the need and fill the need without, and my experience was doing exactly that, without taking the time to say, wait a minute. Whose need am I filling? Am I filling my own need to give to the farmers, or am I actually helping them fill their own needs? And there's not that much of it going on. There is. There are small NGOs that are really sensitive to farmer development on their own. The larger part of the development world basically comes in and from in a top-down manner implements programs that they truly believe are beneficial. And they are, because they're helping people, but by not putting the power into the hands of the people to help themselves, they're missing the enormous opportunity which is before them. In terms of fair trade and the different premiums that are added, the organic premiums and specialty premiums and direct trade premiums that are added to coffee, there are two sides to sustainability, if you will. I hate to use the word. And one is the commercial side, and that adds to the commercial side. And the other is the non-commercial side. And the non-commercial side ignores the price of coffee. It ignores the reality that coffee is a worldwide commodity where the price is just suppressed by the natural marketplace. And the work that the Coffee Trust does is completely non-commercial, and it's about alternatives to coffee. Our Royer Recovery, or the fungus recovery project that we are involved in right now, was the first commercial coffee project that I've been involved with since the debacle I had back in 1988 or 1989, when I realized that I was stepping out of bounds. But it was the farmers who came to the Coffee Trust and begged us to help them because they were ready to close. We had taken basically our food sovereignty program, which was based on agricultural development and based on sharing information from farmer to farmer, and we mutated that to work into Royer Recovery. And so by extending our food sovereignty program to incorporate the recuperation from this rust fungus, that's how we started the Royer Recovery program. And I've been very hesitant about getting back into coffee development, because I figured this is really for the commercial coffee trade. This is what the premiums are for. This is what the fair trade premium, the direct trade premiums, that's what all those premiums are for. They should be involved in that, but they weren't, it wasn't helping. at least farmers who had been devastated. And then having learned this, and then having it connected to the food sovereignty program, which is basically women run. And in the Sheil region, the men are the grow coffee, corn, and beans, and the women grow their family gardens and chickens and do their micro businesses. Because there's a link between the principles and the methodology that both are using, and that the Royer Recovery Project actually grew out of the food sovereignty program, there's a bridge that is being created between the men and the women. And this is an enormous accomplishment in this deeply impoverished rural area of Guatemala.
Has that led to more equality and mutual respect socially?
It's beginning to. And oftentimes, in fact, there's such a synergy going on there. The history is of the cooperative, which is Asociación Chahulense, was created in the middle of Guatemala's brutal armed conflict. And it provided a semblance of hope during one of Guatemala's darkest periods. After the war, a bunch of large non-government organizations, nonprofits, came into the region and with giveaway programs. And they literally took the strength of the culture of the Ishil people, an ancient Mayan people, that had survived the war, and they created a culture of dependency that had never been there before. But the coffee cooperative was still there, and it provided this local economy upon which this community was rebuilding itself. It was the women's microcredit program that started there, was started as an appendage to the coffee program, the coffee cooperative. And several years later, it was able to go off on its own, became its own cooperative, became its own separate entity, and is now sustainable. There are more women in the microcredit program today than there are men in the as coffee farmers. There was a honey project that was also grew out of this Asociación Chahulense. So the association became such an important piece to that community that when they asked me if I would help them overcome the roya, the rust, my first response was no, because they didn't have the money to do it. And my second one, given some input from my associates, was how could I say no? I mean, this organization was too critical to the salvation and development of this local community that had been devastated by war and riddled by poverty. How can I say no? What am I doing here if I'm going to say no to this? So not having the money, the Coffee Trust just embarked on a challenge to help overcome Roya. And in doing this now we've got women who were born from the men's cooperative, who are now extending their savings program to food sovereignty, and the food sovereignty program has grown through the principles of Campesino a Campesino, with methodologies and principles and techniques such as effective microorganisms and different ways of planting, which the coffee farmers are learning from the women, and then there are graduates from our education program, both high school and university graduates, who are working for the Coffee Trust and working for the association now, both in food sovereignty and rural recovery. There's an amazing synergy taking place when you invest in one place and you spend, I've been there for 8 years, when you invest in one place and you invest in every type of development you can possibly afford, that after a while, all of a sudden, boom, things happen you could never have dreamed of. And that's what's happening in the Ishil region right now. So in answer to your question, I've forgotten what it was.
I mean, I think, you know, listening to you talk, one of the things that I'm realizing is that we consumers who are going shopping think that when you look at something that's fair trade, that means that people's lives are being improved in the ways that you're talking about, but that's not necessarily the case. I mean, you were talking about non-coffee economies that have nothing to do, in fact, with the coffee that we're drinking. The coffee is still getting produced, but we're talking about the lives of people, not necessarily better and fairer coffee. And you had said once in an interview that it's not a good idea to mix development and commerce. And I think I'm beginning to understand, but explain what you mean by that.
Okay. Mixing development and commerce on the development side.
Define what you mean by development.
Okay, what I mean by development is the kind of work that organizations like the Coffee Trust or larger organizations do with coffee farmers or people in rural areas who are struggling with poverty and different economic disadvantages that they have. That the commercial world has its own agenda, and their agenda is to purchase whatever product it is. It could be coffee, it could be another commodity. When the commercial world comes and tries to do development in through their people who are producing the product for them, let's say coffee, that they come with a power dynamic. And so the recipients of the benefits are basically left with, well, we better say yes, or we're not going to, oh, they want to build a school, well, we're going to build a school. They want to build a soccer field, we're going to build a soccer. They want to do healthcare, we're going to do healthcare. And it's very different than when a community, you know, assesses itself and says, our biggest problem is education. We really need to get our kids educated. And when development is done from the ground up, it basically comes from the community, that the priorities are set by the community, the priorities are the standards are set by, the evaluation is set by the community. It grows out of the community, and it's not, you know, established in a boardroom or by people who say this is what should happen in that community, or we have people who want to support a school, so we want to build a school in this town. It's very different, and that type of development simply doesn't work. It just dies when the money ends and it's over. That development, when it comes from the commercial side, when there's a conflict between commerce and development. When development is done from the people, ground up, because nothing grows from the top down as far as I'm concerned. And when it comes from the ground up, it actually can achieve a goal toward which the community itself is striving.
That's interesting because there's a plant metaphor in there. Nothing grows from the top down. Things grow from the ground and they grow up with strong roots.
Yeah. Yes, as has the Coffee Trust as well. And yeah. My experience for 28 years has been one very analogous to plant growth.
And it also really bypasses the kind of paternalism which you see from corporate people toward indigenous people or local people or workers, which is that we're smarter than they are, we know more than they do, and they don't know what they don't know how to run their own lives. You're saying, you're seeing and encouraging the exact opposite.
Exactly. In fact, what I've learned is the people who know the most about farming in these rural areas are farmers. And
wow.
Yeah,
you think?
Yeah. And the principles of Campesino a Campesino are basically farmers sharing with each other. And it's not one-way learning. It's not one farmer training another farmer. The learning goes back and forth because the farmer who's learning about, let's say, microorganisms, you know, will tell the promoter who's just like himself, another neighbor, will tell a promoter, well, this is what I've done with my own microorganisms. And then the promoter will go, whoa, that's pretty, well, let me share that with the other promoters. So it's the learning goes both ways, and it's a very natural growth process. To me, it's as powerful as the growth process of plants. And the analogy that I've thought of oftentimes is, even as a kid, I remember walking down the sidewalk and seeing the sidewalk has been broken away and a small little plant, you know, has broken through. And I've looked at that plant and I'm going, golly, the hell did it do that? Well, the power of the growth, natural organic growth, so dwarfs what we think is our own power and own intellect. It so dwarfs it. It can even break through cement.
Yeah.
You know, a little plant even breaks through cement. So when I see the power being exercised in these communities, like in the Ashiel region. And I see the women who are now taking control of their lives, and the men looking at them going, oh my God, look what they're doing, you know. Or the men who were, had given up on coffee, who when we began sharing information about microorganisms or whatever we were sharing with them, and their first response was, oh, well, we'll try a little bit on 10% of our land. Oh, look what that did. You know, all of a sudden, the growth, it becomes natural, and then they start spreading it on all their products, and then all of a sudden, the production starts really developing. Well, the amazing sense of self-empowerment is so awesomely powerful that that's what's really being developed. And so we have a playing field of coffee and food and education and healthcare and alternative incomes, and that's our playing field. But what's really being developed is self-confidence and self-empowerment that the farmers are pursuing on their own development. And our dream, which is not too many years away, is to convert this extremely poor region in Guatemala to be an example of sustainability, so that people can go, here, this is the poorest region, one of the poorest regions throughout the world where coffee is grown. And this region has become, has an element of sustainability that is continuing to grow from day to day. And if it can be done in the Ashiel region of Guatemala, it can be done anywhere. And so our dream is to create this training program that the families themselves are the trainers, and we merely facilitate the opportunity.
You know, I was thinking that from the perspective of the people coming in from the outside, like the Coffee Trust, and doing that kind of development and becoming such good listeners, in a lot of ways, I mean, in some ways, it must take some pressure off of you, because you don't have to come up with all the ideas. You have to listen to them and then just, like, help get it on track.
Yes, and to be completely honest with you, oftentimes, you know, water seeks its own level, and so I'm a human being, and I come from the U.S., and so oftentimes I fall into that pattern where I find myself wanting to do more than I really ought to be doing. And it, you know, it takes a wake-up call. Going, yeah. Well, you know, just as much as I know this can be done very quickly, that the process of allowing it to grow of its own is more important, and I've got to stop myself.
If you could, I mean, you were talking about these kinds of training programs, but if you could look at all the coffee growing regions in Latin America, would you hope to kind of replicate, like, what's your hope for the big picture?
My hope for the big picture, for the Coffee Trust contribution to the big picture, is to provide an example and a facility where what our farmers and participants have learned can reverberate throughout Latin America. That's the big picture for me.
Now, do the people in those regions drink coffee?
Yes. You mean like in the cities?
Yeah, the people the people you're working with.
The people you're working with, yes, they do drink coffee. They don't drink the very best coffee because they save that to be exported. These days, the coffee cooperatives have become very sophisticated cuppers, and they do drink really good coffee because they're tasting coffee, looking for the very best quality, because they know they can get paid more money for a better quality product. They'll cup coffee that has recently been harvested, and they'll be able to tell if it was over fermented or if it was if it had been picked too early, and they'll be able to tell the farmers, you know, before the next day's harvest, to correct their way they're harvesting coffee. Whereas before, there wasn't, this cupping wasn't going on.
Cupping is tasting.
It is tasting, yes. So the co-ops and the estates have become very sophisticated in tasting the quality as it's being harvested, so they can make corrections along the way in case something is not coming out the way they want it to be. It's become very sophisticated. But the rural farmers, yes, they drink coffee.
And yeah. So do you.
And so do I. There you go.
Bill Fishbein is founder and executive director of the Coffee Trust, and he will be part of a conversation about coffee hosted by Iconic Coffee Roasters on Saturday, March 26th at 6 o'clock in the evening That's at 1600 Lena Street, and we were going to try to get everybody in the conversation today, but we just got talking, and so we'll have Iconic Roasters, the folks from Iconic, on the Radio Cafe tomorrow. Bill Fishbein, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.